There is so much that's wrong with politics today, and we're going to help you see some of it and how to make it right next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
It's good to be back with you. I thought we would be back together this week. I told people last week. Boy, spring has sprung and then sprang back.
Yes, we're getting back into the, okay, it's still early spring, and so there's still a little bit of cold and wet and white to come down.
Yeah, and we're recording in a makeshift studio today that's full of stuff because I'm remodeling my kitchen.
Well, and I'm sure that many folks out there listening probably understand that all too well, that a project you think may take a short amount of time and you only need to do one, two, or three things ends up becoming a months-long project and two dozen punch lists.
Well, luckily, this is pretty much on schedule. There are a few things that have delayed us, but we're pretty much on schedule, so I'm very happy.
Well, good, good. Well, speaking of other things that are pretty much on schedule, I kind of want to open us right up today because this week, we're taping this on Thursday afternoon, and just yesterday, on Wednesday afternoon, in the Ohio General Assembly, in the House of Representatives specifically, there was a measure that was passed in the chamber that has, created quite a media storm, Charles. It's no surprise, although you would think that pretty much everybody said what they've had to say about this particular piece of legislation, because this is the third time this bill has been before the General Assembly. The bill I'm talking about is known as House Bill 69, or what I believe all of our folks out there would affectionately call, and we're not saying the words so-called, because I hear that in the major media all the time, but it's the heartbeat bill. This is a bill, and actually specifically this one has been named in honor of recently passed founder of the pro-life movement in America, the national pro-life movement, the international pro-life movement, and really the Ohio pro-life movement, Dr. Jack Wilkie of Cincinnati, who passed away in February. The bill was renamed the Dr. Jack Wilkie Human Heartbeat Protection Act because he personally came to Columbus during the first two times that this bill was before the General Assembly to testify as to why he believed that this was the measure that we needed to go after the Roe versus Wade decision. Well, you know, Dr. Wilkie passed away before he could see this come to fruition and become law and start its way through the courts, which is where we all know it's going. But during this session, this bill was reintroduced by Christina Hagan, who's a Republican representative from Alliance area that's up near Stark County. It's near Canton. And by Representative Ron Hood of Asheville here over here in Pickaway County. And they brought the bill to the General Assembly with 50 co-sponsors. Now, that's pretty important, Charles, because you need 50 votes on a bill in order to get passage out of the House.
Yeah, so unless one of the co-sponsors turns coat, you've basically got a bill.
Or one of your co-sponsors happens to have scheduled their vacation the same week the bill's up for
vote. Oh, gosh.
Which happened, actually. I'm not going to spoil the surprise, but the bill was assigned to committee, and it had a number of hearings. As a matter of fact, it had four hearings. And, of course, you had people from the pro-life movement, and we had pro-family folks come in and testify. We had constitutional law attorneys. There were physicians who testified. But, of course, on the other side, they had their own constitutional law attorneys and their own doctors. And of course, you know, it, just like anything else, if you don't have a fixed standard, you can read things any way you want them to be read.
Oh, absolutely. The words mean whatever you want them to mean. What's your famous saying from, I think it's through Alice Through the Looking Glass?
Alice Through the Looking Glass, where it's the
Humpty Dumpty.
Who starts talking to Alice and he starts using words in different ways. And she's like, "You can't, that word doesn't mean that." And he goes, "Au contraire, my dear, that word means exactly what I want it to mean and nothing more and nothing less." She says, "Well, you can't do that." He goes, No. The only question is, who is master?
Yes.
And that's postmodernism in a nutshell. I mean, Lewis Carroll, he wrote that at the turn of the before the turn of the 20th century. And he really had postmodernism nailed down. That's what it is. I get to define what words mean. There are no fixed meanings. And that's kind of what was happening here. But we've got this situation. But thankfully, the committee that it was assigned to did their due diligence. They heard the arguments. And then on Tuesday afternoon, they voted the bill out. Now, there were, I think, about five amendments that were offered by those who are committed to the pro-death position, pro-choice position.
Pro-death is more correct.
Pro-death is more correct, and you'll understand why more when we after we talk about the next step of what happened here. But the those amendments, three of them were tabled as out of order, not germane to the bill appropriately, and the other two were voted down. And most people would think, well, yeah, it's probably on a party line vote. Well, no, 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 no. All the Republicans did vote against these killing amendment, these bad amendments that would have taken and basically taken the criminal provisions out of the bill. So a doctor couldn't be prosecuted for killing an unborn infant with a detectable heartbeat. And another one that would allow a broad exception for rape and incest exceptions. They were joined by Democrat member Bill Pattman from Cleveland, who voted against those amendments that were brought by members of his own caucus, the Democrats, and then he voted for the bill. Well, it's also because he's also a co-sponsor on the bill. So he's very pro-life, and he believes it. The bill passes from committee, goes to the floor of the House on Wednesday, and of course there's emotional debate on both sides. One of the sponsors, Representative Hood, talked about how he and his wife were faced with the stillbirth of one of their children, and you know, seeing his now lifeless child in his hands, it made him realize that it was unthinkable that anybody could willingly and with good decision want to kill a baby. However, there are people out there, as we found out later during the debate, that definitely are okay with that. There were amendments offered. Again, the rape and incest exception amendment came up, and again, it was voted down. But another amendment was offered, and I think this one's very instructive, Charles. As a matter of fact, I'm a lobbyist, and this is one of my issues that I do, well, pro bono, but you know, I work for Ohio Pro-Life Action as their lobbyist, and we support the bill. And I heard from the committee chairman that a group had come to him asking for an amendment in committee that they didn't get. But this amendment was to allow for a woman to have an affidavit from her religious faith leaders in order to bypass the restrictions on getting an abortion. Now,
but we know where that comes from.
Well, and they're arguing that, no, well, actually, you don't. It's different. I know where you're coming from, and that's from the fact that there's, in the Mormon doctrine, there's a methodology that allows that to happen in their particular doctrines. But this was coming from some members of the Jewish faith. And okay. I'm talking to their lobbyist, and he explains to me, or he started to explain to me, how rabbinic law works and how there's potentiality in the unborn, but that doesn't lead to full humanity. And so I'm going to delve into that a lot more in the upcoming near future, because I'm going to sit down with this person and spend an hour grilling them on their theology to find out where their argument lies, so I can figure out how to defuse it. Because this amendment came up on the floor, thankfully it was voted down, and it'll come back up when the bill goes to the Senate. But again, this is a situation because they're framing it as a religious liberty issue, religious freedom. It's hard to argue against religious freedom, but when you start understanding that it's really a slippery slope, and unless you create so many qualifiers that then the state is then directing your religious expression, you can't go there.
Well, what happened to rabbinic law when abortion was illegal in Ohio?
Well, that was my thought, too, or what happened to rabbinic law on all of the other bills that have come forth that have been like many minor incremental steps in the pro-life movement. You know, maybe going to viability. Okay, well, now we're going to go to maybe fetal pain. That's a couple more weeks back. You know, we're going to do all these little teeny incremental things. But when we have a bill that actually will address the vast majority of, at least in Ohio, the 28,000 abortions that are
The majority of those 28,000
performed
yeah.
in Ohio every year, you have to wonder if the pro-death factions don't see the writing on the wall. And honestly, from the debate on the floor on Wednesday, Chuck, I think they do, because the debate on their side was shrill. It was accusatory. I even had one member on the floor even brought a coat hanger, Charles, and started screaming about how it was unconstitutional for them to even bring the bill to the floor because the courts had decided that it was legal. Well, I think the member is an attorney. But obviously, she didn't go to one of the five law schools that actually teach the text of the Constitution.
That's absolutely correct.
She learned case law theory, and you could tell it because she didn't understand that the courts don't make the law, and that the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade is not there because that's not a provision that the federal courts have authority to do anything with. It's not part of the enumerated powers of Congress, and so therefore they should stay out of it. It's a state issue.
Well, that's exactly it. Of course, we're in week, I believe, 7.
Going into week 8, yes.
Going into week 8 of our Institute on the Constitution class, and we've basically just gone over and had very interesting discussions in our class over the separation of powers both within the federal government and between the federal, state, and local governments. And these questions come up, and the fact is it always goes back to the enumerated powers, and nowhere in the enumerated powers of the federal government, even throwing in the 14th Amendment, which is usually the pivotal point on these arguments, is the federal government given the power over deciding when life begins?
Right.
The answer is that, and even Barack Obama, when he was campaigning in 2008, after he was inaugurated, if you recall, in an interview, he was asked that question, when life begins, and he said, that's above my pay grade. Well, it may be above your pay grade, but the fact is, you have to come to the conclusion that life begins when the biology says it begins, and the biology says it begins when sperm meets egg. In other words, there are now, instead of 23 singlets, there are 23 pairs of chromosomes, and that's virtually within moments after the uniting of egg and sperm. So those are kind of arguments are lack substance, to say the least.
Yes.
The Constitution does not speak. And actually, the Supreme Court is not empowered, really, to decide when life begins. It's not really empowered to say when life ends, which is another problem that they face on the other end of the spectrum, usually, but not always. And they're not doing a very good job of it because they're allowing political ideology to get in their way. And they like the idea at the federal court level that rights can be created by government when, in fact, rights are merely discovered and protected by government. They're not created. Rights are a gift of God and God alone. And that includes the right to life. And that is given to every individual person. And we're not saying that you can't abrogate that right by the certain crimes that are committed. The Bible's very clear about that. God's word is very clear. You can abrogate your right to life, but the fact is you have that right to life.
Now, Chuck, I'm gonna ask you as a student of the Bible. I could say scholar. I was gonna say I know you're gonna jump at the, when I said scholar. As a student of the Bible.
Yeah.
Did you know that Matthew 22, the Great Commission,
mm-hmm.
To love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, and your strength, and your soul, and to love your neighbor as yourself, is a warrant for a woman to have an abortion.
I did not know that, and in fact, someone would have to exegete that point very strongly.
And they did exegete that point very strongly on the floor of the House yesterday during the debate, when Cleveland Democrat representative, freshman representative, I might mind you, Stephanie House, stood up on the floor and basically said and read that passage from Matthew 22 and said that a woman aborts her child out of love. And so therefore, by implication of reading the passage and then saying that phrase, that she was indeed fulfilling the Great Commission because she was loving herself by aborting the child. And so if you're loving yourself that way, then aborting the child is loving. Chuck, it was the first time in all of the many, many years that I have been around the Statehouse, that I have listened to session, that I have talked to members, that I found myself wanting to become physically ill. The unbelievably, breathtakingly bad theology coming from this member in pursuit of holding a sacrament for them, inviolate, it was amazing. I mean, these are the type of people who would call you and I zealots.
Yes, exactly.
For our faith.
Misquoting the Bible, and by the way, Matthew 22, this is...
verses 38 and following.
Right, verses 38. This is the first commandment. It's actually 36.
36.
Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and with all your mind. Okay, that's the part I'm sure she quoted.
No, she quoted the whole thing.
Oh, the whole thing. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself.
That's where she stopped.
Yeah.
She quoted that whole section and then said, a woman aborting her unborn child was doing it in love.
Well, let me ask a question. Who's your closest neighbor when you're pregnant?
Good question. That would be...
That would be the neighbor that is growing inside of you.
That's right.
Whether you like it or not. The fact is, that is, and it is not an act of love to murder your neighbor.
And you know, Chuck, let's put it this way. I am willing to be educated on this topic. So if someone in our listening audience actually has a scripturally sound and scripturally based rationale or argument to back up Representative House's point, well, first of all, I'd be totally shocked. But secondly, I'd have to look at it seriously. But the point is, all she did was what we call script torture.
You
rip a passage out of context, out of framework, and you because you don't even really understand what it says, you use it for whatever you feel like. Oh, wait a minute, Chuck. Didn't we just talk about postmodernism and defining words whichever way we want to define them? Wow, look at that way. We do it with scripture as well. Folks, that right there is the crux of the vast majority of the problems we have in our communities, in our families, our communities, our state, and our country, and our world.
Well, one of the problems I see with the argument as you related it is the idea that this passage says something about loving yourself. I see nothing in here about loving yourself. I see loving God.
Yes.
And loving your neighbor.
Right.
There is exactly zero in here about love of self.
That's right.
In fact, one of the problems that we have in this society, and one of the main tenets of the arguments presented in favor of abortion, is love of self.
Yes. I think it honestly was where she was going to. She just got so hung up in the weeds that she didn't know where she was.
Well, that's the problem when you have people that go. She may go to church, I don't know. But my guess is she goes to church where the pastor does not preach the word in an exegetical fashion, at least not in an exegetical fashion in which orthodox theology is a major guidepost or guiding principle for the preaching of the word. In fact, usually what I find is people that go to liberal churches, the word is used eisegetically. And what that means is you basically make the Bible say what you want it to say. And that's the old saying that we've joked about. Gary DeMar used to say all the time, Judas hanged himself, go and do likewise. And what you do, do quickly, because there is no God. That's four different Bible passages all kind of rammed together and made into this mix of stuff that is not biblical.
Yes.
So you can make the Bible say all kinds of things by ripping things out of context. But exactly what Jesus was talking about was the exact opposite.
Yes, it was.
In this passage in Matthew 22, the exact opposite of what she was saying that it said.
And Chuck, for those who may be a little incredulous about this claim, listen for yourself. The house floor sessions are videotaped.
Yes, they're available.
And they're streamed, and they're online at the Ohio House website. You can go to the video for March 25th floor session. This was the first bill that was up on the calendar, so it's probably somewhere like in the half hour to 40 minute range of the debate. You can listen for yourself. Hear what she said. I mean, I am not taking it out of context, and I'm not twisting it around. Now, another comment that was also made on this bill on the floor, and we're going to spend some time on this because I really want to drive home the point, is abortion is a sacrament to the left. Now, after a number of speeches on both sides, some relating some very personal things, one of the members, Representative Teresa Fetter from the Toledo area, abruptly got up out of her chair and addressed the floor almost in fury. And you can listen to her on the video as well later. Almost in fury, it's like she basically revealed that while she was serving in the military, she was raped, impregnated, and then had an abortion. And, you know, she said, you know, you don't respect my reason, my rape, my abortion. Well, this is the first time she's ever publicly told anybody about this, Charles. She even admitted that she did not. And she says, quote, talking about the people who supported the bill, quote, what you are doing is so fundamentally inhuman, unconstitutional, and I've sat here too long. I dare every one of you to judge me. Okay, well, honestly, we're not your judge, Representative.
No.
But there is somebody who is, and his word's true, and you are running afoul of it. Now, the thing I got out of this, yes, it was personal. It was painful for her.
Yeah, agreed. It probably was very painful.
But the only things that she brought across, Charles, was she was in the military, she was raped, she got pregnant, and she had an abortion. What she didn't say was, did she ever report it, and did her attacker ever face justice? Because her baby certainly faced injustice.
Exactly. The baby was given the penalty that the rapist deserved.
Exactly. Now, and she called supporters of Heartbeat, which means you and me, Chuck, that we're inhuman. Okay, I want to give you the definition. Inhuman is an adjective. It's a descriptive term, Charles. Inhuman means, and I quote, lacking human qualities of compassion and mercy, cruel and barbaric. Chuck, and listeners, what's more inhuman than taking a living soul that is defenseless, that is judicially innocent of everything, and tearing it into pieces and burning its body? There's nothing more inhuman, showing a lack of human qualities of compassion and mercy, or being cruel and barbaric, as abortion. But yet, the irony of Representative Fetter using that particular term to describe and to try to vilify people who support protecting those defenseless lives through our law. It didn't escape me, Chuck, but I hope that ultimately it doesn't escape her.
all we can do is pray that she sees the folly of her own ways. Whether that happened or not is in the hands of God.
Yes, it is.
However, that kind of rhetoric is what we've come to expect. And really, Barry, we're going to post a couple of stories on this. And I have been reading the commentary. And it's very clear that logically, the proponents of abortion don't understand the arguments. And they don't understand the arguments that they make, and they don't understand that they're a fallacy. In other words, it's almost a showcase. In fact, I am currently for Camp American, and yes, I'm going to teach a class at Camp American this year on critical thinking. I'm going to use this and the commentary as a part of my teaching tool, because the commentaries are so illogical. It's so chock full of logical for instance, there's talk about prosecuting men for masturbation and making noise about every sperm cell that's quote-unquote murdered should be counted as a different count of murder for the purpose. Now, fallacy is that?
Well, first of all, before I answer the fallacy, let me ask you a clarifying question. In any of those cells, is there any more than 23 chromosomes?
No.
Okay, then it's hard to murder because human life is 46 chromosomes.
Right.
It's hard to murder not life.
So this is this is what's called a category error.
Category error, yeah, okay.
A sperm cell and an egg are not the same as a fetus.
No, not at all.
And a fetus is a fetus at one cell once it's been fertilized.
One cell with 46 chromosomes.
With 46 chromosomes.
Right, because and we talked about this in a previous program about if you have trisomy or other things.
Exactly.
Where you have a chromosomal misfire. The point is, you still have a full complement of chromosomes. One of them might have doubled up a little.
Yeah, doubled or tripled. It does happen. Nonetheless, there are category errors. There are straw men galore setting up scenarios where this and this and this would happen, and therefore, again, this is not the way to debate on these issues. Now, I've seen debate on our side of the issue that's equally as bad.
Oh, I have too. I have too.
So we're not saying that everybody on our side has the logical high ground, because we don't.
No.
I'd say you and I do. But some of our people who would call themselves our allies, not so much.
Not so much. And that's okay, because, you know, it takes all kinds. Just like on the left, it takes all kinds.
Yeah.
Now, I thought it interesting here because, you know, as we look at liberals versus conservatives, left versus right, Republican, Democrat, and those are not all equalities there. I'm not saying all Republicans are conservative and on the right.
Exactly. Yeah,
I'm not saying all Democrats are liberal and on the left, because... Well, one of the co-sponsors of the bill was a Democrat, Bill Patman from Cleveland.
Exactly.
Who voted against all the bad amendments and voted for the bill.
Kudos to him.
And he was great. But you had others like Mike Curtin, who's a representative from Columbus, who was a former editor of the Columbus Dispatch.
Strike one.
Who seemed to start talking like Rand Paul on the floor, or Ron Paul even, talking about how it was just absolutely unfathomable and a quote, profound abuse of power to say that government should come in and tell a woman that they know better than she does, or a doctor that they know better than he's. Well, the point is, Chuck, if doctors and women are making stupid decisions which are ending the life of defenseless, innocent, unborn children, somebody does need to step in. And that legitimate somebody who has the proper authority given by God is the civil magistrate.
Well, we need to give Ron Paul a pass, because
Ron Paul was a gynecologist,
and he birthed umpteen thousand babies. And his viewpoint was not that
That's right.
the government didn't have the right to step in. What his viewpoint was that the federal government should have nothing to do with it at all. And if you listen to the front part of this broadcast, you'd know that that's basically our position as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I should have just left it at Rand, because Ron, you're right.
I honestly don't know where Rand Paul stands.
Well, I'm kind of wondering that myself. Hopefully he'll clarify that sometime, since he seems to be running for president.
I will tell you that he will not clarify it for as long as possible.
Of course he won't.
He's more political than his dad was.
But I thought it was interesting because, you know, Harrington is talking about how government shouldn't get between these women and her choices. I don't know if he still is or not, but previously, Mike Curtin sat on the board of Pregnancy Decision Health Centers here in Columbus. I wonder if they counsel women who have had rape or incest or other difficult pregnancies to go get an abortion.
PDHC?
Yes.
Never.
Exactly. The height of hypocrisy coming out of Representative Curtin's mouth on the floor yesterday. I mean, it was almost like each one of the liberals were trying their best to trump the other one in ludicrousness, from misquoting Matthew 22 to inadvertently describing what you're doing in terms of the other side with the inhuman quote, and now Curtin talking about how it was horrible for a government to tell a woman what to do. It's like, okay, well, I'll give you half of that. Okay, government isn't telling a woman to have intimate relations with anybody,
or not to, shouldn't.
But once you've had the results of that particular engagement, that's a separate life. And that's a separate life that can't speak for itself. It's a separate life that can't defend itself. And therefore, it is the legitimate role of government to interpose between the butcher and the baby.
But
the liberal pro-death crowd, including Representative Curtin, who spent an awful lot of time on the floor talking about how all these national pro-life groups didn't support the bill, casually ignoring the fact that almost every state pro-life group and local pro-life group in Ohio is fervently behind the bill, with one notable exception, who has chosen to remain silent up to this point on this debate.
But yes, they because they got beat up very badly the last time around because they came out in opposition. Vocal opposition and got really thumped for it.
And let's not kid ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, they're still opposed to this bill.
Yes.
But they've decided, instead of taking the brickbat to the head because they're out there in the public square, you know, not being able to defend what they're doing, They're most likely working behind the scenes over in the Senate and with the administration to try to keep the bill from ever finalizing. Because, Chuck, think about it. If we pass a bill that stops 95% of all abortions, and we pass a bill that ultimately is upheld by the Supreme Court, or ultimately enough states start passing that somewhere along the line we change the law of the land, supposedly Roe v. Wade, what's that going to do to their retirement plan? Because honestly, that's the problem. It's mission creep.
Yeah.
Instead of it being a cause in order to win, it's become a job in order to keep.
And that's one of the problems. It's one thing that you should notice for people who were and are, for instance, activists who deal exclusively with the Republican Party. It's how they basically become co-opted by the party. Suddenly, they say, you know, we like your issue, but you need to do this, and we'll make sure you get lots of money. And all of a sudden, all this money rolls in, and they're like, and they buy the big house or the big apartment in downtown D.C., and they get invited to cocktail parties, and they get the ear of all these people who then say, well, I'm not going to do that, but I'll do this.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, they've drunk from the Potomac, and they're on the other side. And these are the guys that eventually, very often, run for office.
Like president?
Yeah, or even governor of Ohio sometimes.
Oh, maybe sometimes and, that too.
Because I happen to know that John Kasich worked at the grassroots level in very conservative circles in the mid-70s, because I know people that worked with him,
mm-hmm.
and said he was the real deal till he got elected to Congress. And then all of a sudden, about three terms in, John went from being very conservative to moderate slash liberal.
Yep.
And that long fall has continued to this day.
Yes, it has. Well, the governor has stated that, well, he's opposed to this bill because he doesn't believe it's constitutional. Okay, that's great. Problem is, sooner or later, you're going to have to deal with actually either you or your successor are going to have to deal with actually ending the scourge of abortion.
Barry, he's scared to death he's going to have to deal with it before he runs for president.
Yeah, I'm sure he is.
And what's being done in the Senate, basically, you and I talked about this offline, what's going on in the Senate with what's being said over there by people in leadership. Now, you're a lobbyist, so you have to be careful.
Yeah, a little bit.
I can tell you that there are people in leadership over there who are engaging in what amount to almost laughable fallacies, asking for using the fallacy of the universal negative. Now, what does that mean? That means tell me that something will never, ever, ever happen. It never happened up to this point in history. In the history of the universe, and never will happen in the future of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
That's a universal negative. So what they're saying is, you have to assure us that this will never be smacked down at any level of the court before we'll support it. That's an absurd position, because nobody can assure anybody of anything. You can bring in every expert that you can find from every walk of the law, and they will never tell you that some federal court judge or some Supreme Court judge or some state court judge isn't going to strike it down at some point.
Mm-hmm.
That's an impossibility.
You're right.
So those kind of statements are absurd on their face. And I'll say that. It's people in high leadership in the Senate. So I said it and you didn't.
Well, that's fine.
And if they ask me, I'll say you shook your head while I was saying.
No, Chuck, that's one thing about being a confrontational lobbyist. We're not afraid to name names. He's talking about Senate President Keith Faber, who's protecting the governor.
Yeah.
That's exactly what's going on here. And he's using this logical fallacy in order to say, you can never answer my question satisfactorily, so therefore I don't have to do anything.
Right.
Yeah. Chuck, I'm no wielding violet, okay? I don't care. You know, I'm not the type of lobbyist who goes in there begging them to do something and showering them with gifts and with campaign funds and taking them out to dinner and getting them drinks or whatever. I don't do either. Matter of fact, here's just a little shot. Most of the time, if I ever go out to a meal with a member, they buy mine. It's like, I'm okay with that because I'm a nonprofit lobbyist. Not just that I work for nonprofits, it's that there's really no profit.
Well, I can tell you, you work for me as well.
Well, I do too, yes.
I have a company, and you hear the advertisements very often before the show starts, and usually they play one for my company, and then they play one for Barry's company at the same time.
That's right.
And I do hire him for work on that affects my business. And the fact is that about half the time I buy lunch, and about half the time you buy lunch
when
we discuss business issues. So
that's the way it works.
Yes, we are looking at some things that are going on. We're trying to find out. I've got him sleuthing in the legislature right now to find out what's going on.
I have a report to give you after.
Okay, very good. So you're earning your keep. But that being said, we laugh about that kind of thing. In fact, I was kidding him on Tuesday when we drove through Asheville, where our class is. And as we drove through town, I said, "Did you see your new car there off to the right?" And he said, "No, what was it?" And I said, "If you drive through town, there's a Corvette for sale." I said, "Shouldn't every lobbyist have a Corvette?" And he laughed.
I had to laugh because I'm sitting here with a vehicle that's just turned 315,000 miles, and I'm still trying to keep it on the highway.
Yeah, about half the time you're in a rented car, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's
unfortunately.
That gets
bandied about, but yeah, confrontational lobbyists are not the big money J Street guys.
I'm not the big DC lobbyist with the big cigar in my mouth.
No.
And wads of cash falling out of my pockets to hand to politicians. I'm a confrontational lobbyist. We actually like talk policy and communicate with voters and have the voters communicate with their members. And oftentimes when the member doesn't do what the voters want them to do, have them communicate very loudly. Oh, say at the ballot box. That's what a confrontation.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very important position to have. So when we talk about these issues, it's not something that Barry isn't pretty well informed on. Usually he's right up to snuff with what who's saying what in the legislature and the reasons why they're saying it. And we're here to tell you that the reasoning is bad here. I saw this coming a mile away because Kasich does not want to deal with this issue because he knows he's already in trouble with issues like the Common Core, which he is running away from at this point.
I think you're mischaracterizing our poor governor because really, and you're right. He's nuancing.
Yeah, nuancing. Yes,
moderating. Softening, backing out the doorway so he doesn't get hit in the back of the head on Common Core. But the point is, and you brought this up, and this was an article from CNN that we're going to be talking about here, that John Kasich really is on a quest to reshape the Republican Party. Now, you brought this up to me, so don't you laugh so hard. But the point is, if you've been listening to a lot of the comments that the governor makes on the stump in public speeches when he's in front of groups, et cetera, you start hearing some familiar themes. We've talked about some of them. You know, I have the right to define what conservative is in Ohio. I have the right to define, you know, Republican orthodoxy because he's governor. Okay, that's great. But according to this article from David Chalian of CNN, and then there's an accompanying video. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
That he really is wanting to try to break out of the traditional mold, Charles. And you know what the traditional mold is, especially if you're running for president as a Republican?
Pro-business.
Well, not specifically. It's make sure that you talk up the base.
Talk up the base.
Make them feel that you're right with them on all of their heart issues. Get them to vote for you in the primary, and then as soon as the primaries are over with, it's run as fast as you can back toward the left so that you can recalibrate and be centric so that you can appeal to the business and the moderates and the independents and maybe some of the more soft Democrats so that you can build a quote-unquote winning coalition.
Yes.
Well, according to what you found, maybe the thinking is changing with John Kasich that he's trying to build that coalition before a Republican primary.
Mm-hmm.
Charles, I'm thinking this may not turn out so well.
This strategy has never worked for any. Okay, think John Huntsman.
Yes, well, that's fine. We could think of numerous boneyard candidates. John Anderson.
Who else is running? Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham.
I mean, that part of the field is really pretty crowded. The soft left, quote unquote compassionate conservative. Is really fairly full of candidates. Chris Christie, who's essentially is, if he runs, it's going to be a waste of time and money because he's not going any place. I think that friendly embrace of Barack Obama basically killed it with the base. And that's the problem. These guys don't want to have to run to the center. They want to run from the center. You can't. Okay, let me ask you a question, Barry, and this is something that kind of came to me when I was thinking about this.
Okay.
You know what a chimera is.
Yes.
We need to explain what a chimera is. A chimera is a creature that has characteristics from all kinds of different animals.
At least three. It has the wings of an eagle, the body of a lion, the neck and tail of a serpent, and I think it was the head of a dragon.
That's
right?
A classical chimera, but yes. There are animals in nature that are chimeric.
Well, that's true.
Think of a duck-billed platypus.
Yes.
It's a mammal that lays eggs.
Uh-huh.
It has that duck bill, so it looks. If you've seen one, it looks, the front end looks like a duck. It has poisonous quills. It has all kinds, you know, like a porcupine. So it's really a strange-looking thing.
It looked like it was a prototype model.
Now, what Kasich would like to do is take a chimera, this creature that has all these different-looking parts from different kinds of things, which is really what the Republican Party is. The Republican Party is a chimera. Okay? And he wants to make it look like something more acceptable. Well, how do you make a chimera look more acceptable? There's only one way to do it.
Dress it up to look like something else.
No, you do surgery to cut the parts off that are the most offensive. So what do they try to do? They try to chop the parts off that are quote-unquote the most offensive or the thing that makes it look the most different at the front end.
So in other words, you're saying the most extreme things.
Quote-unquote.
Quote-unquote, yes.
That strategy has been tried over and over and over and over, and it has never worked.
That's right. Now I find it interesting because in this article on CNN, which we'll have up on the website, you know, they were talking about, and let me be the first to say, Charles, I don't necessarily disagree with the governor on some of his policy points. You know, and there's a quote here. He says, if you don't help the mentally ill, they end up in a prison or in a jail or on the streets. There's a societal cost to that that's ongoing. If you don't help the working poor to figure out a way to become independent, there's a societal cost to that as well. I absolutely agree wholeheartedly with that. As a matter of fact, I've been working my backside off down at the State House trying to get some innovative things going so that we can get people. And the way one of my clients, who I love dearly, phrases it, we give people an entry ramp into public assistance, but we never give them an exit ramp. They want to build the exit ramp. It's like we get people if you have to go into public assistance, whether it's welfare, food stamps, Medicaid, so on.
It's a one-way door for the most part.
Any governmental social program, that door only goes one way and you can't come around and come back out no matter how hard you try. We want to create an off ramp to get off that highway and get back into the real world for a lot of people who are the chronically unemployed. It's you know, all of these different scenarios. So I don't disagree with the governor on that. What I do disagree with is calling what CNN calls a fiscal conservatism,
yes.
That is rewarded by a greater human experience. Now, a fiscal conservatism, okay, Charles, that seeks out and takes $13 billion in federal money to expand Obamacare, Medicaid.
Which he says didn't happen. It wasn't an expansion of, yeah.
But it did. And a governor who, now that he's in his second term, and this is his third budget, his budgets have grown every term. As a matter of fact, every one of his budgets have been higher in spending growth than the previous ones. That's not fiscal conservatism.
Not by any stretch of the imagination.
But that's okay. I mean, even if you say, okay, temporarily we may have to do some spending in order to get at the nub of this other problem over here, that'd be fine. But your problem is the Medicaid expansion, the $13 billion, well, that's federal money that in 3 years the state has to start picking up tabs on part of and a greater part of and a greater part of while the rolls keep expanding. That's not fiscal conservative either. Now, the hope, I guess, is that as we are picking up more of the tab, we're getting more people off of the rolls. But the problem is that we have a force, usually the federal government and oftentimes liberals at state government, who want to keep expanding the pot out, who want to keep saying, well, no, okay, 100% of federal, 138% of federal, 200%, 400% of federal poverty level. Let's just cover everything. Tell you what, if somebody isn't making $2 million a year, let's give them government assistance. Well, okay, I guess if they're making $2 million, we've given them another kind of government assistance sometimes.
Okay, to point out the problem with Kasich's scenario wherein all the money comes in from the feds, basically, first of all, that money tends to dry up. So then who's responsible for it?
Right.
Yeah, Kasich is basically painting himself as a budget balancer. He hasn't balanced the Ohio budget. He's kicked the can down the road so that basically my kids and grandkids will have to deal with the debt that was kicked down the road and made to disappear.
Oh, you're wrong. You'll have to deal with the
Well,
debt.
That's true, because it's going to happen right after he leaves to go to Washington
because
retires.
It's interesting because there was an analysis done by the former head of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions here in Ohio.
Yes.
He's now with a group called Opportunity Ohio. He's a PhD by the name of Matt Mayer. Now, he put a brief out just recently that looked at the holding everything level with what was going on, and basically showed that by fiscal year 2017, which is the second year of this budget that we're getting ready to pass, we will start having structural deficits in this state that by the end of fiscal year 2019 will be $7.5 billion in deficits. Chuck?
That's where we started with this budget mess.
At coming out of the Strickland administration.
Exactly.
Was an $8 billion budget hole. We're projecting a $7.56 billion budget hole if we just basically took on the face of it the executive budget and did it, and they expanded that out with your reasonable budget growth. Well, they even reduced the amount of budget growth that has been over the last two budgets, you know, the percentage growth. This budget grows again if you just went with the executive report. Over the biennium, it grows the budget by over 16%.
My guess is that $7.5 billion prediction by 2019 is very conservative.
No ball, probably. Well, that's holding that everything else stays the
same.
You know?
Now, Barry, if you'll recall, when this budget was being dealt with, and this method that he was, we predicted that this would be the outcome. It's all you're doing is kicking it down the road. And we said, based on his record, this is what he does.
Mm-hmm.
This is, if you recall, Kasich got quote-unquote famous for balancing the budget in the mid-90s when he was the House Budget Committee chairman. This is exactly the method that he used. He pushed all the debt down the road. Well, guess what? That debt's here back to haunt us now that was pushed down the road. All the bills are due. Well, what's the problem? Well, Social Security's short, Medicare is short, all these programs are short. Well, how are we going to deal with it? Well, we'll have to raise fees. As if they can sell the idea that a fee isn't a tax, when we know, of course, that a fee is a tax. We've dealt with that issue before. But here's what's fascinating about this, Barry, in this same story. Under that paragraph that you described, his fiscal, the former House Budget Committee chairman, who has been barnstorming the country trying to get enough states on board to ratify a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, says fiscal conservatism can't simply be about getting the ledger sheet to show a surplus. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something about the balanced budget amendment. I do an analysis of that. In a little talk that I give on the Constitutional Convention that John Kasich so badly wants. That balance the budget amendment does nothing. It requires no balanced budget. The loopholes in it are so numerous and huge that what will happen is a political firestorm will essentially be ignited to get us this quote-unquote amendment of the Constitution by convention. And if we happen to survive that, which Barry and I are both of the opinion we will not, the Republic currently stands, then we will have amended the Constitution to a place where it isn't now. And that is that basically what the balanced budget amendment says is you don't have to count borrowing as a revenue.
Right.
And payments do not count
as debt.
As debt.
Now, I wish I could do that in my own life, Charles.
Oh, no kidding.
I'd love to go down and borrow, you know, let's say $10 million and then not worry about paying it back because,
yeah.
I don't have any extra income I have to show and I don't have any debt.
Yeah. And the law says, well, you don't have to count your borrowing and you don't have to count your payments. What? That's so absurd. The law only applies to your debt as it stood when we started. It doesn't have anything to do with borrowing. It doesn't have anything to do with the payments going to pay the debt. Barry, it's the most absurd thing I've ever seen. Casey has to know this.
Whether he does or he doesn't, it because the vast majority of people, number one, have never read the amendment to start with.
Right.
Number two, don't know what's in it. Number three, doesn't know how that federal budget process works. It all sounds great. That's wonderful. It's all window dressing. But again, this is something that that Kasich's kind of known for. Now, it's interesting because later on in that article, when they were talking about this whole idea of him reshaping the party, he's like, who are these people who are defining what it means to be a conservative, unquote? Kasich asked, taking head on those who criticize decisions to expand Medicaid and willingness to consider a pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants currently in the United States. So because he's getting questioned on those two things, then they don't have the right to say that he's not a conservative because they don't get a right to define it. Who does? He says, maybe people who say those things, and he's talking about the things he's saying, are reshaping the party. We have a right to reshape it. I have no right to say that you're not a conservative, but you have a right to tell me what the party should look like, and I'm a party member. Okay, Chuck, what's wrong with that picture?
He just disqualified himself to be president because basically what he said was, I have the right to decree what conservatism is, and you have no right to speak on it at all. What's wrong with it is about everything. The fact is that opening the borders wide open and letting people come in and use our systems, bypass our laws, is not conservatism. Basically, allowing people, what amount to big bankers and big businessmen to take over whatever remains of our free money system, which isn't much, in the form of a quote-unquote balanced budget amendment, which basically makes things even worse than they are now. If it was a true balanced budget amendment, okay, fine, but it's not. And that's where Kasich is so far off that it's almost embarrassing. But he is so self-centered and egotistical that he can't see that his own rhetoric is essentially knocking a hole in his own boat.
Well, you know, Charles, I wouldn't mind because, you know, he talks about these ideas about these foundational American values of personal responsibility, resilience, family, and faith. Yeah, those are great things.
Yes.
But they don't come around with government telling you what to do, and they don't come around from a party leader telling you what you have the right to do and not to do.
Right.
You know, again, let people make their choices in a free market. Let people help other people by reducing regulatory and tax burdens on them, not just shift saying, well, we're getting rid of one tax, but we're going to shift it over to you in another fashion by putting it over here on things that you're going to have to pay for anyway. Don't do those things. And don't script to torture.
No script torture, right.
No script torture, no going to Matthew 25 and talking about how when I was poor and naked, you clothed me. When I was hungry, you fed me, et cetera. And saying that that's the role of government.
Right. It's the role of the individual.
As a matter of fact, we'll post it up. We don't have time to talk about it now, but we will post up on the link on our website the article from Marvin Alasky who takes John Kasich to task on doing just that.
We'll have to find it. Okay. We're out of time for this week. I would remind you that Camp American registration is open. If you want to hear some of these issues given to you both barrels You want to learn about logical fallacies and how we were able to analyze this using essential simple fallacy detection, then come on over to www.campamerican.com. You can always find these podcasts at www.principledpolicy.com. That is our website. You can go over there. You can find out how to contact us. You can make comments on our articles, whatever you'd like to do. So we would ask you to join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.